You're listening to Give Me the Bible with Len. Today's program is entitled Constrains. Hello, my radio friends. Welcome to the program today. In this program, I'd like to share with you some thoughts about a particular Bible verse, and as well, I want to share with you a story. But first, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul speaks about reconciliation. Reconciliation to bring wayward human beings back to God. In verse 14, he makes this profound statement, "For the love of Christ constraineth us, because we thus judge that if one died for all, then we're all dead." Instead of using the word constrains or constraineth, some translators of other versions of the Bible use words like controls, compels, impels, urges on, or motivates. The Amplified version of the Bible puts it this way, "For the love of Christ controls and urges and impels us." And as far as I know, no version of the Bible says the love of Christ forces us against our will. Now, some people have suggested the verse could alternatively mean that our love for Christ does the same, although I think the Apostle Paul meant that Christ's love for human beings is the active force. When people who otherwise have no interest in becoming Christians begin to understand what Christ did for them and what motivated him, it's hard to ignore that for such to happen was nothing except a grandiose act of love. They may ask, "Who? Me? Why should I deserve such an outpouring of love?" It's hard to ignore such a beautiful act. And such was the case with someone we'll call Joe. And this is Joe's story. She says, "When I was a child, my grandmother took my sister and me to church with her. She would pray with us and read the Bible with us. But I never had a good understanding of the gospel or who Jesus even was. For a while, as a child, I thought my pastor was Jesus. I went to church because I had to, even though I would much rather have liked to have slept in. Looking back, I realized that what I had was religion, not a genuine relationship with God. I didn't know what being a Christian actually meant or looked like. I went to church, I believed in God, and I could recite the Lord's Prayer, and that was the extent of it. Most of my childhood, I never took time to get to know God. Fast forward to my first year at high school. It was then my dad passed away with cancer. I remember that night so clearly. We were faced with the choice of taking out his breathing tube and see if he would make it. I was 14 years old, and I'd never experienced death before. So in my immature brain, I thought I'd see him again soon, that death wasn't that big a deal. But little did I know that that night would be the night I would wrestle with it for years to come. My choice to take the breathing tube out was made out of selfishness. I just wanted to go and hang out with my friends. I blamed myself for my dad's death, and I carried that weight on my shoulders for years. I couldn't forgive myself for what I'd done, and that's when the self-hate began. I turned to anyone to numb the pain, friends, boys, and even girls. I just wanted to feel loved by someone. I wanted to feel wanted. I was what you'd describe as the heartbreaker. Once I felt loved and wanted by someone, I would move on to the next person. When that wasn't enough to numb the pain, I started to take pills. When I was 16 years old, my mother made the decision that we were going to move interstate. And that's when everything went more downhill than it already was. I wasn't excited about leaving all my friends and my ways to escape the pain. Once, when settling in after the move, I felt so alone and started cutting and starving myself. Then, once I started making friends, I turned to drugs again and began drinking. I was in a place of pure darkness and self-hatred that I didn't think I could get back up. I had no hope. All I wanted was to die and would come up with ways I could kill myself. But, thankfully, I never attempted anything. The summer after I graduated high school, I went to a national youth gathering with the church I grew up in. That's where I learned who Jesus actually was and what he came here to do. I remember them asking us all to write down on a small piece of paper our biggest regret or something that we blame ourselves for or a weight that we carry with us. I wrote down how I blamed myself for my dad's death. They took all the thousands of pieces of paper and dumped all of them at the foot of the cross that was on the stage, and they set them on fire. You could see all the piles of paper turn into ashes scattered at the foot of the cross. That's when I realized that I didn't have to blame myself for my dad's death anymore. Jesus took that to the cross with him. Jesus forgave me, and I could forgive myself too. But leaving this gathering, I went back to my self-hatred, sinful ways. I wasn't willing to change my life for Jesus quite yet. But that seed was planted. I started to grow more and more numb as time went on. About a year later, I went on a mission trip with the church I grew up in. That's when I realized that there is a way more to life than just me. Life is about serving others and doing something that matters. Leaving that mission trip, I knew that I needed to get plugged into a church when I went back home. I knew that I needed more of God in my life. Coming back home, I made excuses about going to church. I deeply desired to go, but my flesh kicked in and tried to stop me. But thankfully, God intervened. I took one step of faith after another, and that's how I started going to church, getting involved in a young adult Bible study and serving. The first day I went to church, I instantly went to a Bible study that same day, and then went to the young adults Bible study 2 days later. And if you knew me at this point of my life, I didn't go places alone. I suffered from anxiety, so going anywhere alone just didn't happen. But I knew that these were steps I needed to take, and it was hard. But I leaned into God for help, and he was faithful to meet me where I was. Once I started making friends at Bible study and going weekly, I began to learn so much about Jesus and the Bible, and I got to see what real Christianity looked like. There was something so different about this group of people that I admired, and that was that they had Jesus in them. They lived their life honouring God and wanting to please him in everything they did. Through my pastor challenging me and answering all my questions, I slowly started to grow in an actual relationship with God. I started making prayer and reading the Bible apart from my everyday routine, and not because I had to, but because I genuinely wanted to. And through spending quality time with God and other godly people, slowly, God continued to weed out the sin in my life and transform my mind. It wasn't overnight. It was a process that God was patient with me in. But that's the beauty of it. God doesn't say that you have to change everything before you come to Him. It's quite the opposite, actually. We run to Him, and then we'll start to change. The funny thing is that because of my grandma taking me to church when I was younger, I believed in God, and I would pray seldomly. There were even seasons of my life that I would read my Bible. I felt God's presence on occasions, but it was all surface level. It didn't dig deep. I didn't try to get to know God for who He was, but only for what I could get from Him. Now, ever since fully surrendering my life to Jesus in 2014, God has radically transformed my life. I'm a completely different person than I was back then. I live my life fully surrendered to God. And let me tell you, it's a sweet surrender. It's beautiful how God can take a mess of a story and turn it into a symphony. It's not a perfect symphony. I still miss notes sometimes, and every once in a while I'll even break a string. But God is always there to conduct me through the trials and help me to overcome. I can't imagine where I'd be or who I'd be if I didn't open the door that Jesus was knocking at. By His grace, I'm set free from who I was. I'm eternally thankful for a God who loves people so much that He would send His Son to be the ultimate sacrifice for us so that we can spend forever with Him. And this is how Jesus changed my life. And this is the end of the story from Joe. And now I'm going to share with you some other thoughts. There were various influences in Joe's life that were responsible for her changing from being unhappy, miserable, and suicidal. But, as she said, Jesus forgave me, and I could forgive myself too. But there is another thing that Jo pointed out in her story. God doesn't say that you have to change everything before you come to Him. It's quite the opposite, actually. We run to Him, and then we'll start to change. In Jo's case, when she realized she was loved by Jesus, the changing process began. She appreciated what He was willing to do to win her allegiance. It was love at work, as summarized in 1 John chapter 4, verse 19, which says, "We love Him because He first loved us." If someone really loves you, it's hard to say no to them. Love is a driving force. It is there for you to accept or reject. But that powerful influence of love begs a response. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 14, this is what is written. "For Christ's love compels us, because we are convinced that one died for all, and therefore all died." In this verse, Paul speaks of his motivation for ministry, and I'm going to go on straight after the break.
Than song in sound.
Now I was going to share with you some thoughts about that particular part of the verse in 2 Corinthians 5:14, for the Christ's love compels us. You know, there is many different types of motivations as there are personalities. And of course, the intensity of those motivations can range from mild to obsessive. A teenager might babysit on the weekends because she's motivated to save up for a new phone. The leader of a free country might be willing to sacrifice the lives of thousands of soldiers in order to protect the lives and liberties of those in his realm. Without the right motivation, very little progress can be made in anything. Jesus spoke of the importance of motivation when contrasting the hireling and the shepherd. The hireling, that's an employee, might take care of the animals because he wants to get paid. But as soon as he sees danger, like when wolves come along, he abandons the sheep to protect himself. The shepherd, on the other hand, not only takes care of his flock, but he's willing to put his life on the line to keep them safe. When the Apostle Paul wrote, "The love of Christ compels us," he was describing the powerful, spirit-filled motivation that also drives followers of Christ to share the gospel in ways that persuade people to commit their lives to Jesus. When Paul explained this motivation to the Corinthians, he wanted them not to be ashamed of either him or the message of reconciliation that brings life to those who embrace it. Paul understood the futility of life without Christ and the empty pursuit of righteousness through self-effort. And even though the people to whom he preached were often hostile to him and even called him crazy, the love of Christ compelled him to keep putting the message of hope in front of them. Paul knew that his detractors were starving for a sense of meaning and purpose and significance in the world, much like we see today. The love of Christ compelled Paul to share the gospel. The phrase, "the love of Christ," could be interpreted in two ways: Christ's love for people, or the apostles' love for Christ. Either of those two provides motivation to take the gospel to distant lands or other places in face of opposition. The great love of Christ was such that Christ died for all people. Paul's love for Christ was such that he was willing to die to self. This testimony of Paul's encourages us to ask ourselves, what motivates me to share the good news of Jesus with others? Are we driven by a genuine love and affection for Christ, by a clear view of Christ's love for the lost, or is it merely from a sense of duty? What motivates us will make all the difference. When we possess this compelling, spirit-driven motivation of Christ's love, we are zealous in seeing the lost reconciled with God. We go to the lost rather than letting them come to us. The love of Christ compels us to love the lost enough to share the good news of salvation with them. And my dear listeners, this is why I'm sharing with you. I want you to be saved too. Now, some of you might understand the theory, but I want to give a few practical examples to help you understand the implications of the motivation of love. Say, for example, you buy a new car. How do you treat that car? If you're a normal person, you're likely to take care of the car and keep it in as good condition as possible. Why? It's because you like or love that car. Another one, you get married. Do you mistreat your partner? Do you stay away from your partner? Do you neglect him or her? In my case, when my wife and I married, in our wedding vows, each of us said to the other that we would love each other until death should part us. Why do we stay married? Simply because love constrains, love compels, and love motivates us to be faithful. And the same goes with Jesus. It is his love expressed through his substitutionary death on that cruel cross in order that we might be saved that makes us respond positively to him. Another illustration. Imagine yourself involved in a severe car crash and you're trapped inside and the car catches fire. Then someone comes along in the nick of time and frees you. How would you feel toward your rescuer? I think you'd feel grateful for the rest of your life. And that is the response we should have to Jesus. His love, his act of rescue, constrains, compels, and motivates us to make a response of love back to him and to help save others who are lost. My friends, may you make an appropriate response to Jesus and let the love of Christ compel you to love back.